Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino. On this episode, we talk with Army veteran, motivated leader, and podcast host, Rich LaMonica. He grew up in the northeastern United States and spent many years in the Army. He talked about being active during major periods of our recent American history, getting injured in combat, and what he saw and tries to use to help current veterans. He is the creator of the Misfits Nation podcast, a platform he uses to share stories of courage, mindset, resilience, and battling those enemies within. He also highlights the work of veteran entrepreneurs, small business owners, authors, musicians, and other podcasters. Enjoy this interview.
Thanks for taking a minute out today. I appreciate it.
No problem. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure, man. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you do and kind of your history, you know, COVID's been kind of the elephant in the room around the world, and it's really kind of altered a lot of ways that we approach and see things. What did COVID do for you?
Oh, it made me busier, I guess, to say the least. So COVID started in 2020, I guess. It kicked off the day before New York, or the weekend before New York closed down. I was up in New Jersey for my dad's 80th birthday. I flew out of there on March 8th. I think March 9th or 10th, New York, New Jersey closed down because of COVID. I was in North Carolina and watching the wave kind of close as I was there for work. So I got home and my work went from live work to basically the virtual reality work that we all do now, working from home, teaching from home via WebEx or Microsoft Teams. And I was finishing my master's degree at that time. I finished that and so I didn't get to walk across stage. My goal was to walk across stage one time in my life, and that was the second chance I had to walk across stage, and I did not make it for my master's because of COVID. So I was challenged to go for my doctorate, which I'm going for now. So I took up the last 8 hours of my time after starting my doctorate to start my podcast. And so I work 40 hours a week. I work going for my doctorate and also doing my podcast. That keeps my time pretty busy. So my life has become, I guess, more full as far as that day goes because of COVID.
Wow. So you're going to be able to, hopefully, if things maintain, you'll be able to walk the stage with your doctorate.
Oh, Lord willing, yes.
That would be the most magnanimous one anyway. I mean, you know, that's the end of the hat trick, so that's the way to christen it. So you'll have to have a triple celebration for that one.
Definitely.
So are you up in New York?
No, I'm in Tennessee. That's where I live.
Okay, you're in Tennessee. So before we get to your work, your very important work that you're doing right now, let's start at the beginning of your life. Talk to me a little bit about where you were born and raised, kind of your childhood and how these seeds of who you are now began.
Oh, sure. I was born and raised in New Jersey in the 1970s. I was the fourth of four children. We lived in a railroad apartment right across the street from it was what we called the bowl. It was an unused space in the city, so it was like weeds and stuff. Basically, an urban playground for us kids in the neighborhood. Freight trains would come by in front of us and stuff like that. And about a quarter mile from our house was the trains to go right into New York City. So we grew up in my dad was Italian. His mom and dad were full Italian. So we were raised pretty much Italian Catholic, and all those values were instilled in us. Mom was the enforcer in the house. They both worked at least two jobs at a time to try to, you know, provide for the family and make things better for us than it was for them as they were growing up. I went to Catholic grammar school. I attempted Catholic high school, was kicked out because I just did not like it. It was an all-boys school. I was not doing well there, so I wound up in the worst high school in the city, William L. Dickinson High School at that time, and now it's one of the better ones. I swam. I played baseball there. And I kind of just was going through the motions because I knew my main goal in life was to join the Army. But as I got to the end of my junior year, I told them I was a younger person because my birth date, I was underage to sign up on my own for the Army, so I'd have to have my dad help me go sign up. I told him I wanted to join the Army, and he told me, enough of us have joined. Enough of us have served our country. You need to go to college. I was like, well, I haven't taken a course to get ready for college. There's no way I can get into college now. He said, well, you better think about it and get it done. So I signed up for all these hard courses for my senior year. So instead of being a slacker during my senior year, what I did was I had two maths and three sciences or vice versa. And my whole day was scheduled. All my friends that were seniors were going to maybe two classes and then maybe a shop class and going home. I was in classes with juniors and sophomores and taking all these classes that they already knew they were on the path to go to college and taking. And I was just burning out. And the day of my SAT test, the Scholastic Aptitude Test, my dad woke me up because I was late. And he said, "You're going to take your test?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I guess I got to go." We didn't have a car, so I had to run the 3 miles to get to the testing site. I got there just in time, slid into my desk. Somehow I passed it, and I made it into Berkeley College, it's called now. I went there for a year studying business. Accounting was my major at that point. And then I realized I can transfer from there to a better school. So I was kind of getting in the groove of it. So I transferred to St. Peter's College. I don't know if you watched the NCAAs this year, the Final Four, to March Madness, the St. Peter's Peacock that made it to the Elite Eight. And so it revived a lot of memories for me from my, I guess, my 18 through 22-year-old self time. I played football there for 2 years. I walked on, played football. Like I said, I didn't play football in high school. I played football there because I just needed something to do to get my anger out, so hitting someone was probably the best thing to do. We lost every game we played, a lot of life lessons there, and humility and becoming humble. After about 2 years in that college, I decided I have to join the military because I couldn't afford to pay for it, so I was paying for it myself. So I go to school. I was working at UPS from 11 at night till 3 in the morning, and then starting school at 8 in the morning, then going to football practice, and I was just burning the candle at both ends at a young age. So I went to the recruiter. I joined the reserves first, and it was about the time of Desert Storm, so 91, 92-ish. I went through basic training. Right after Desert Storm, I went to basic training, AIT, and I stayed in the reserves for about, I want to say, 18 months total. 93, I went active duty, and I reported to Fort Stewart, Georgia. And I got there the day that the battle for Mogadishu happened. And there I am, a brand new active duty soldier, learning on the fly what being alerted is, what being deployed is, and getting all these shots. I have no idea what they were at the time. Hey, just go in this building and they'll take care of you. They take care of you, give you a bunch of shots, making sure you get all the your will updated. So at 23 years old, I wrote my first will. Powers of attorney, all that stuff was going on. When they finally realized that I was not the right MOS, I got pulled off the deployment, and I got to stay there and go to my first field prom in NTC. Came back in December, met my now wife in December. We got married in May of 94. She wasn't pregnant. It was just let's make this happen. We eloped, and 5 years later, we had our church wedding, or Hollywood wedding, we call it. Our daughter was born in between her in 96 at Fort Campbell, same place we had our Hollywood wedding. From there, we went to Fort Raleigh, Kansas. We were there from 99 to 2005. In 2001, I was deployed already when 9/11 occurred. I was on the border of Iraq and Kuwait. We were out there just doing our normal daily, basically kicking rocks and being a deterrent to Iraq when 9/11 happened. And we got the call saying we were at Threatcon Delta. So we're like, well, we never had that call before. So we drove back, and I thought it was a lie. I thought it was just another alert, and our lieutenant, he was a jokester. So I thought he was just joking around when he got back there, and he said the World Trade Center's been hit by an airplane. A second one, one hit the Pentagon. I said, "Man, sir, stop lying, stop lying." So I sent one of my soldiers to the CNN tent where they had all the news on for us, and he came back and said, "Hey, son, he's not lying. We're at war." So it made our mindset change from, hey, this is just basically a vacation in the Kuwaiti desert at 120 degrees to, hey, we're on the verge of war in the Kuwaiti desert at 120 degrees. We stayed there from September till December, pushing all the other units up to Afghanistan from there. Came back. They sent us to the desert to train to go to the desert again. 2003, went back to from Fort Raleigh, went to Iraq to Ramadi. They call it Rest of Ramadi. It's in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. A couple movies have been made with references to Ramadi, including American Sniper with Chris Kyle. It was a bad place. Every time we drove out the gate, you'd hear the ding of a bullet hitting your vehicle. We lost 35 guys in our brigade proper, plus another 30 Marines that were assigned to us that year, so 65-ish in that year. There's a pretty big learning curve for a lot of us about who we are and what we can do in adverse situations. From there, came back. I wound up getting stationed in Alabama and taking care of our nation's chemical weapons stockpile. for 3 years with 300 of probably the best people I've ever met in my life, all civilian workers. They became like family, and most professional people destroying those chemicals, transporting the chemical weapons, make sure everything was safe and no one was in harm's way. It was another learning curve from there. It's not many people get to see that in our country or in our military, even get to see actual live chemical agents or live chemical weapons. I got to see them and then see them destroyed. After that, I went to Korea for a couple years. I brought my family with me this time, and we had a great time. They didn't want to come back. 2010, came back to Fort Campbell. And 60 days later, I was in Afghanistan, and that's where I met my platoon. My platoon, they were already deployed and everything already by the time I got to Fort Campbell. So I met them over there, and that's where my show is called The Misfit Nation, and that's where the misfits were. Well, the Misfit Nation was born in 2010 on the battlefield of Kandahar, Afghanistan. And we, another tough deployment for that unit, 65 within the brigade proper were killed in that year, plus multiple, many were wounded, and both physically and mentally from that deployment. Came back in 11, we're home for about 8 months, I think, and we were told we're going again. 12 went again, I think it was 10 years ago today I deployed. Got to Afghanistan, and we did all the in-processing stuff there. Got to our COP, we started getting to know what we're supposed to do and do right seat, left seat rides with the unit that was there. They were showing us the battle space, and we were attacked with mortars. The second day I was on the COP, and during the second volley of mortars, one hit behind me, went through my back of my left leg and out the front of it. And I didn't realize it, and so it was adrenaline kind of. My medic was right in front of me. I was congratulating him on a job well done on the first attack, and he looked down and said, "Hey, Sergeant, you bleeding?" I thought, man. So I took my tourniquet out, put it on. I told him to go help someone else who I thought was more wounded than I was. Went in, and we stayed with the battle until we can clear out and do evacuations. I wasn't going to get evacuated. I thought I was too tough for that. And I had a special forces medic come up and ask me, "Hey, Sergeant, you know what gangrene is?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you want it?" I said, "No." He said, "Then get out of here." So I got on the bird and flew to Fob Fenty. And all of a sudden, I'm in surgery, and I thought I just had a scratch. Came out of surgery, first time ever on crutches, and I'm on rocks, trying to walk with crutches. It was another learning curve for me. But I took that challenge, and they wanted to send me to Germany. I said, "No, I'm not leaving my guys. I got to get back out there." And they said, "No, you have to get more." I said, "No, I'm staying here. I'll get a flight back to my COP." So less than 32 hours from wounding to getting back to my COP, I was back in the fight. Although with the crutches and a bad limp walking around Afghanistan, I was told I would never run again, which was one of my passions at that point. We completed the deployment, didn't lose anyone else within our team. We did have one major incident within our unit. Warren Groberg, the Medal of Honor recipient, Medal of Honor recipients, was in our unit, and that's when he received, when he did the actions to receive that, was in August of that same year. So we seen him a couple days prior, just before it happened, him and Sergeant Major Griffin, who we did lose in that same incident. And that was the worst, probably worst day of that deployment, was the day that happened. But we stayed in the fight, and we trained our Afghan partners to do what we thought was right. If we flash forward to what happened just this year, it wouldn't look the same, but hopefully things turn around for them. From there, went back to Fort Campbell, and I PCS'd to Maryland for my last couple of years. Did some work up there with the chemical reconnaissance teams up there. Came back down to Fort Campbell to retire for 2 days, and that was in 2015 of this month. So 7 years ago this month, I retired from the Army. And I took about a year off from there because no one would hire me. They thought I wanted a lot of money. They thought I was asking for more or I was overqualified. I just wanted to get out of the house. My wife wanted me out of the house. So it was exactly 365 days I was out of work. And then I got a job with the Mission Continues, a veteran nonprofit. And I moved as a GO bachelor to St. Louis to work there for a year. And then they let me work for a year from home. And then I found I lost my passion for that job and found another job, the job I do now, where I teach soldiers about emerging threats. So I've been doing that for the last 3-plus years now and really enjoy that. I'll pause there. I think I went for a long time.
Yeah, no, that's great. And there's a lot of, in the timeline there with follow-up questions that I have. seems as though in the beginning, you know, you wanted to go in the Army and then you, you know, you went to school and then went back. Seems like you always had the desire that was supposed to be your life was to get in the military.
Definitely. And that as a young kid, I think, I don't know what which war I was watching on TV with my dad, because I'm not sure if it was Vietnam or something that was happening in Israel. But we'd watch the news and I'd see soldiers on TV and I said, that's what I want to do. That's the coolest thing in the world, to go out there, wear that uniform, and get to shoot at people. Because at that time, as a young kid, you don't realize that, you know, you're really killing people, but you think it's just like the playground. But I thought that's what I wanted to do, and that was in my head. My goal was to become a soldier.
Now that you're in a position where you have all these experiences, that you can lend that and help others, how satisfying is that? I mean, even with Misfit Nation and with the work you're doing, I would think that's pretty essential, because there's a lot of people that need that comfort from someone that's had so much experience like you.
Oh, definitely. Even with my first job coming out with the Mission Continues, I was mentoring other veterans, and that was it fulfilled my purpose. And, you know, when you take off the boots for the last time, you lose that kind of sense of purpose. You don't know what to do with your hands for a little bit. And when I found that purpose again, helping others and helping them, like you said, through my shared experience, or through the experience I had to help them get through their experiences or their mental blockage they were having at that time. And even now, as the Misfit Nation is growing, 150 episodes now, talking to great people, great guests, and learning. I've learned so much from my guests. It's amazing just to hear them tell their stories, or even the journeys of my authors, my musicians, or those who were in Hollywood doing things, learning how they made those steps and how they've taken those journeys. And there's different journeys for every person, but I've learned that at some point in all of our lives, we all have gone through some kind of hardship, or we've had to tackle some kind of challenge. And everyone I've interviewed has had some kind of challenge. No one was born with a silver spoon in their mouth. And it's been great to see that we all share that same kind of grit. We kind of share that mindset that we can get over stuff. We can take that challenge and accept it.
You know, I've never been in the military, but I would have to think, you know, of all the stories that we've heard and we've seen in the movies we've seen, and just with you talking about, you know, people in your group that fell, you know, how much of the pie chart when you're in the military do you look at it and say, right place, right time, wrong place, wrong time, the right group I'm with? How much of that plays into, wow, I survived and they didn't?
As something my dad told me a long time ago, we all have an appointment once we're born, when we're going to go. So it comes out to your beliefs at that point. So fate, and like you said, right place, right time, wrong place, wrong time, or one step to the left and I'm done, one step to the right, I'm done. And you never know when it's actually your appointment time, but you know when you're in battle, you know that every time you walk out that gate, there's a chance you're not coming back through that gate. Or any time you go out to take a shower on the copper fob, there's a chance a mortar can come in and take you out. And that's something we learn to accept, and it's kind of a different mindset that learns to accept that, I guess. But you have to have that in your head that, A, this could happen, and B, I have to prepare those who love me for that before I leave. So you have to have that whole mentality to do that. So sometimes it is right place, right time, but most times it's that intervention from above.
So my dad was full-blooded Italian. He born in Brooklyn, raised in Massapequa, Long Island. Right. And he wanted nothing more than to get out of his house. He joined the military, got in the Air Force, and got to Richards Gebauer. So sometimes people are like, how did a Domino end up in Kansas City? And so I explained that was his thing. But he was in there when the Bay of Pigs happened, and he remembers the DEFCON lights going up. And he was like, here we go. And, you know, that was kind of the around the time Vietnam was coming around. He never went to conflict. He got out before that. But I always remember that was a big part of his life, the military. And I always look at how well the military takes care of their people. I mean, he passed in 08, and he had diabetes, and he had a lot of issues, and everything was covered through the VA. And I always think about him. And when people talk about the benefits they get, you know, the soldier is taken care of when it's all said and done.
Oh, definitely. And actually, today I had a VA appointment, and it was, I guess when I first got out of the VA, I heard all the horror stories from a lot of the Vietnam guys, like the grunts and stuff that came back, missing arms and stuff, that were told that, hey, that's not service connected, or we're not going to help you because of this. And they just pushed them away in hopes that they would never come back. And that was their whole mantra was not to help the veteran or not to help them up front, make them fight to get the help. And I think their fights, like your dad, my dad, and their generation, the fight they went through to build the VA to a better place to where it is now really helped me and my brothers and sisters. So now when I walk in there, you're greeted. They ask you how you're doing, what they can do for you that day, and is there anything wrong with you that they haven't seen? So they really take care of you a lot now, and they ask you, they try to take care of things that you don't even know is wrong with you. So, and then I think that's a much better place for us now. And like you said, like they took care of your dad all the way up till the end, and that's great because some guys just quit and didn't try to keep go back in there. So that's an awesome thing.
Yeah, for sure. So who's your hero?
My hero, well, there'd be two. My dad is my number one. My father always been there for me, always give me timely advice. No matter how dumb a thing I did, he'd give me advice on how to get out of it or how great a thing I did. He's always been there to be my biggest fan, my biggest cheerleader. Like I said, when we lost all 14 games playing college football, he was the only parent that came to every game. He was there to watch us, and he'd give us advice at the end of the game. You guys probably need to do this better. You need to do that better. You have this down, but you really need to work here. When I wrote my book, he was the first person to get one and send me a picture of him reading it in New Jersey. That made my day. Everything he's done has made steps for all four of us to be better in our lives. And then I guess outside of the family, the person I always looked up to through my military career was Colin Powell. Very strong leader, awesome dude. Always took care of his men first, worried about his men, then worried about the mission. And, of course, you've seen him, how he skyrocketed up through the chain, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, a great man, great overall human being. And I always looked up to him, emulated him, tried to lead the same way he did.
So at this point in your life, after everything you've been through and you've seen and you have a successful podcast channel, what is it that you look forward to every day you wake up? What new thing do you want to do and that you're looking forward to?
Each day when I wake up, I try to stack victories. So, you know, get up. Waking up's a victory at this age, you know. So yeah. Once you get over 50, you wake up and you're all pieces are working at that time. You get up, that's a victory. You make your bed, that's a victory. But I look forward to, if I have interviews that day, I look forward to hearing the stories of the people I'm talking to. Because most of them I never met before. And this is the first time I'm getting to talk to them, just like me and you right now. We've never met each other. We're both Italian backgrounds, both from the Northeast, New York, New Jersey area. But we would never have met if it wasn't for podcasting. And we would never have learned each other's, you learned most of mine. I learned some of yours, your story. And that's a great thing to learn every day. And then, of course, play with my dogs every day, see if how much they can hurt me during the day is another thing I look forward to.
You know, that is the beauty of this process, is that there's so many people that exist in the world that you never learn about. I mean, we tend to get into hero worship and all these things, but, man, there are so many feet that are on the ground doing wonderful things. And the stories need to get out there. Like, all the stories that you're getting, that's what we do as humans. It's the cornerstone of what makes us go forward is that story. I'm sure, you know, being on deployment, the guys that had the great stories, those were the ones that kept everybody's spirits up.
Definitely, yeah. So there's some great dudes that had great stories on deployment, make you laugh, and sometimes just ask, how did you live to get to war, and things like that to them. But there's always great stories.
So if you could meet one person alive on the planet right now, who would it be?
Ooh, alive right now? George W. Bush. That great advocate for the military when he was president, and he's also an awesome advocate for the veterans now.
Absolutely. I'm always surprised that he became a painter. That was like his thing when he got out of office. It's like no one ever even knew, and I don't think he ever really did it, that which was a part of his character. It's like, yeah, I'm just going to be a painter. I'm going for it, which is cool, you know. Everyone has a perception of who they think you are. Your family, your friends, those that you interview, all of these people around you, but you're the one that's ultimately living your life. Who do you think you are?
I think I'm just an average Joe. I tell everyone I'm a pretty simple man. I don't expect a lot from anyone. I expect people just be professional, and the same thing I give them, respectful professional courtesies. I don't need lobster and caviar. I can have cold beer and whatever kind of meat I'm allowed to eat now. Chicken or turkey, I guess, the only two meats I'm allowed to eat. So a cold beer and some chicken or turkey, and that makes my day and a good conversation. I'm a simple guy.
I'm wondering, I keep thinking this, you know, coming from the Northeast and the Jersey, New York area, what kind of culture shock was it to come to Tennessee, or has it been kind of an easy transition for you?
Well, my biggest culture shock was when I went to Georgia first, and, you know, you're in New York, New Jersey, you go into a store, you buy something, they're like, hey, get out of here. Good, get out of here. There's no thank you, there's no hello, there's no good morning. I went to a store in Georgia, and I bought something, and the person's like, how are you today? Have a good day, thank you. I said, what do you mean? What's going on? I was in shock. But my wife is from Georgia, and she kind of eased me into all the Southern nuances. And so it's been 27 years now we're married, or 28 years, I'm sorry, 20 years married, and I think I'm doing all right in the South now.
You know, it's interesting. You know, being from Kansas City, you know, I interview musicians, a lot of musicians, and everyone always talks about wanting to come back to Kansas City and how nice everybody is. But I do hear that from up east, you know, Boston, New York, that area, like, it's literally in and out. There's no pleasantries. There's no, you know, any of that. You know, I did go to Florida a few years ago and drove up to the South. I've never really been through the South, and I had never seen boiled peanuts.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I was like, what in the hell are you guys doing?
This big old bag.
Yeah. I was like, I've never seen that. What is that? You know? And of course, for me, eating just regular dry peanuts, going to baseball games, that whole thing, like when I got them in the thing and started eating them, I'm like, they're just wet. What are you doing? It still isn't something that computes, but maybe if I lived there and gave it more time, but the jury's out. So
luckily for me, I was allergic to peanuts, so I never had to eat them, but my wife loved them. We'd go like dad, like outside every gas station, there'd be their special recipe on them. Like you said, I thought they were just a bowl of water with peanuts in them. So
that's right. Oh man, it's totally bizarre. So let's get to the good business here of where everybody can learn more about you and your Misfit Soldiers podcast, anything related, your books, anything related to your world. Where's the best place for folks to go?
The best place for everyone to go is to themisfitnation.com. That's our website. It has all our episodes on there. It has our store on there. It has our contact information on there. So if you want to just check out the show, it's a great place. We have our gear on there. My book is on there as well. My book is also on Amazon under my name, 13-Step Guide to Success. And then if you want to be a guest on the show, you can register as a guest on there, and we'll see if you're a good fit for the show, and we'll get you on there.
Beautiful. Rich, hey, man, thank you for what you've done for the country, what you continue to do with your very important work. It's been great to get to know you, man.
Awesome, Joe. Thanks for having me on today, and let me share my story with your audience.
Thanks for tuning in to another famous interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, and music around the globe. Most of the music on these episodes comes from Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store. You can see these on the Neon Jazz YouTube channel. And for everything Joe Domino related, go to JoeDomino.com, and there you can contribute to the cause via PayPal or Patreon. Until next time.